I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. We call it an American conversation with global attitude. This one is about the dense web of church and God issues around the presidential politics of 2008. First question could be, is it okay to talk about this stuff? Article 6 of our Constitution says, no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust. But in fact, serious people wonder if we haven't slipped already towards something like theocracy, church rule, not just in George Bush's God-blessed foreign adventures, but in the strategic maneuvering that never stops to win faith-based foundations of party politics at home. Our guests bring two acute angles that you've never heard together before. Martha Nussbaum at the University of Chicago is the celebrated philosopher, historian, classicist, and legal scholar, herself a convert to Judaism. The project of her new book, titled Liberty of Conscience, is to summon a modern hero out of 17th century American history. Roger Williams founded the colony of Providence, Rhode Island in the 1630s, in flight from the meddlesome Puritans of Massachusetts. He personifies today most of Martha Nussbaum's answers to the riddles of church and state. It's part of a project also to raise for our time a fresh standard of religious freedom in which the key word is equality. Jeff Charlotte is the other part of our conversational project, a curious and fearless journalist of religion on the ground in America today. Jeff Charlotte is a student of this mega church era of Christianity and also of the secret councils of fundamentalist power that are hidden in plain sight in Washington even now. His new book on the family, the Jesus network that he joined so as to understand, makes the case that we're already in the grips of zealots who are pushing state religion at home and an aggressive imperial American righteousness around the world. Both of these books, I must say, fascinated me. Martha, I wish you'd begin especially by introducing this extremely attractive character, Roger Williams.
Okay, I'd love to do that because he's a real favorite of mine, Chris. Roger Williams grew up in England, and he had the education of a young classicist and young Anglican clergyman. And actually, he was ordained in the Anglican Church. He was a friend of John Milton. He learned Greek and Latin. He learned, I think it's very important, the thoughts of the Stoics, which did have a lot to do with what he later said about human equality. But then he got very upset with the religious persecution that was going on in England, and his own beliefs were shifting toward the Puritans, so he took off for America. And when he got there, he found that it wasn't a haven for toleration and respect, but it was actually a place where meddlesome Puritans, as you say, were trying to establish an orthodoxy. And the first thing that really upset him was the unfair treatment of the Indians. He always had an affinity with the Indians and loved to study their language. He actually wrote a long book about Narragansett Indian language that's still used by linguists and is very good. So he lived with the Indians. He thought they were property rights were being disregarded. And then I think out of that experience of finding moral decency and honesty in people whose religion he utterly hated, he said they were satanic, but he still loved them as people and respected them, he thought the Puritans were doing things wrong. They really were not respecting people. They wouldn't allow them to seek their own way. And so he developed a view of conscience, which I think is really, really attractive, which is that every human being has within themselves something very precious, which he called conscience, which is a capacity to seek for the ultimate meaning of life in your own way. And the thought is that we all have this equally, whether we're using it right or wrong, it ought to be respected. And respecting it means giving it lots of space to pursue its own way and not establishing an orthodoxy that squeezes it. He had two really neat images for religious intolerance. One of them was imprisonment, as consciences were imprisoned all over the world. And the other, even more striking one, was rape. Consciences were being raped. He called it soul rape when somebody sets up a religious orthodoxy and denies a space to others to find their own way. So out of all this, he just left, and he founded the Colony of Providence, which later became a group of settlements and eventually was joined by other people who were not welcome elsewhere, such as Jews, Baptists, Quakers, the Indians, all found a safe home in Rhode Island.
Martha Nussbaum, I got to say, I think I've always had a Massachusetts view of Roger Williams as a sort of cranky rebel who left. I'm in Rhode Island now. And he suddenly seems an almost uncannily modern figure. I mean, how can this have happened?
Well, you know, I think he is modern, first of all, because the core of his thought is one about human equality. I mean, so he's a precursor of the Enlightenment, if you will. But I think he does get this ultimately out of the Stoics, who did maintain that we all have equally a power of thought and choice inside ourselves. So anyway, he had this idea that we all deserve equal respect. And then he asked, well, what would it be for government to show equal respect to all its citizens? And he came to the conclusion that it required, first of all, extensive and uncompromised religious liberty, but second, it even required bending over backwards to give people special dispensations in case normal laws trampled on their religious liberty. So, for example, if the law required you to go to court to testify on a Saturday and you were a Jew, you didn't have to obey that law. So this is what's come to be called in the law accommodation. And he really did invent the concept of accommodation on grounds of conscience, which is very, very important in American law today. And then I think even more modern is the idea that there's a moral space that we can inhabit together in the political realm that really does have a moral content. It has values in it. It has values of respect, values of liberty, and so on. But it needn't be a religious space. So we can, whatever our different religions, we can share allegiance to core moral values such as honesty, respect, and so on. And we can live together on the basis of those values. And then each of us will connect those values to our own religions in different ways. But we needn't bring that aspect of it into the state. And I think that's a very good idea to live by, because I think it's a better idea to live by than the idea of separation of church and state, because that says to religious people, oh, you've got to leave what's most important to you at the door. You can't bring that into politics. And I think what Williams thought is, well, you can in a way. You can bring the moral part of it into politics, and that's a very important part of it. You just don't want to bring the theological part into politics, because that's what you can't share with others.
We've got to come back to that. That sounds like what Mitt Romney was saying, and nobody much credited him in the 08 campaign. But stick with it for one sec. You're picturing him as a kind of precursor of the Enlightenment and even our own Enlightenment giants, Jefferson, for example, or Madison. And yet he was not a skeptic. He was not a deist. He was not dubious about religion itself.
No, and neither, of course, was Madison. I think he's not similar to Jefferson. Jefferson did get to his conclusions often through a kind of scoffing attitude toward religion. But Madison, by contrast, was quite a pious man. And although he probably didn't read Williams directly, because Williams's books were published in England, he knew what was going on in Rhode Island. He knew what later happened in Pennsylvania, which was very important to him because he had a college roommate from Pennsylvania. And so he observed what it was like for people to live together on terms of equal respect, and he liked that. And he kept writing to his roommate saying, look, what I saw in Pennsylvania just is so much better than what we're having down here in Virginia. Mm. So he became a lifelong opponent of all forms of religious establishment out of that experience of what equal respect could actually look like.
Martha, I love your own prose on this man. You say, Roger Williams' romantic and deeply emotional picture of the conscience as a lonely and vulnerable traveler in life's great wilderness is the source of a distinctively American set of religious attitudes that have deep roots in many of us and that are attractive starting points for political thought. You call it our tradition in America, but where can you point to it as a living tradition in our world today? This is going to be a question for Jeff, too.
Well, you know, of course, in philosophy, in my bailiwick, the ideas that John Rawls worked out about religion and the state in his great book, Political Liberalism, are very similar to these ideas, and it just develops it a bit further. But no, in the political realm, you know, I think that basically in American law we have lived by these ideas. And one place we really see it is in the way that the Establishment Clause has been interpreted over time, because the question that has standardly been posed is the question, does this public display or this prayer or whatever make a statement that says there's an in-group and an out-group, that some citizens are more privileged than others? Justice O'Connor was a particular backer of this way of interpreting the Establishment Clause. She called it the endorsement test, and she made much of the fact that she was following Madison and that she really did think that the core of the idea of establishment was one about equality and equal standing in the public realm. And that idea is very much alive, although, of course, there are people on the court who don't agree with that.
Hmm. Before I get to Jeff, Martha, I'd just love you to elaborate the equality standard, which runs through your whole book. Equality as a test of religious freedom, as the guide and monitor, so to speak, as opposed to separation or simply the word freedom or non-establishment. Why do you fix on equality?
I mean, just to start with separation, I think that it's not... No one, if they think about it for 5 minutes, would really say that they favor a total separation of church from state, because that would mean denying the churches the use of the fire department, the police, the public water supply. And no one really favors that. And why don't they? Because they can see it would be terribly unfair. The religious citizens would have their lives and safety unequally at risk. So the question is, what sorts of separation do we want? How much and where and why? And I think we can answer that only by thinking about the more fundamental idea of fairness or equality. That is, the reason that we want separation when we do, for example, we don't want Christian church to be able to hijack public land to set up holiday displays, is because it's unfair. It makes a statement that some people are more important than others, that there's a privileged group of citizens and a non-privileged group. So that, I think, is the key question that we always have to ask. Again, with the liberty side of it, how much liberty do we want? Well, we know one thing is that we got to give people equal liberty. So if some people are able to keep their jobs while observing their holy day, and other people are fired because they won't go to work on their holy day, well, that's unfair. And so the Free Exercise Clause has standardly been interpreted to say you can't do that, because it's not just some liberty, it's equal liberty that we want.
Where do you see the infringement of equality today?
Well, you know, I think on the free exercise side, the liberty side, I think we're in pretty good shape, because most people, even evangelicals, believe that people ought to have a lot of space to pursue their own conscientious commitments, and they're even willing to be sympathetic with small minorities who, let's say, want to use a hallucinogen in their sacred ceremony or whatever. In fact, those laws that restricted that have been overturned by overwhelming majorities in Congress. So where it is, I think the real threat is on the Establishment Clause side, because people say, well, you know, what's the harm in just saying we're a Christian nation and in having lots of public displays and public celebrations that announce that? On the Supreme Court, Justice Scalia said explicitly that it's fine to celebrate monotheism. And he thought the Ten Commandments would be fine to, in courthouses and in public schools, because the three great monotheistic religions all share that. And he explicitly did include Islam. But he then said, you know, we don't have to be bent over backwards to be fair to Hindus or Buddhists or other non-monotheistic religions. So this idea that we can establish some religion or group of religions as the key ones for our society is a very, very common and powerful idea. And I think it's one we should really worry about. And we should worry about it because it makes a statement that other people are not fully equal citizens.
Martha Nussbaum, I want to introduce Jeff Charlotte, a most extraordinarily learned and sensitive reporter on the ground of American religious life. His new book is called The Family, subtitled The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. Welcome to Open Source, Jeff Charlotte.
Hello, Chris. Hello, Martha.
Does Roger Williams speak to our American condition, Jeff, to your American condition?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, reading Martha's book, I just fell in love with Roger Williams. And I think, to me, he's best understood as a prophetic thinker. In the sense, you mentioned the beginning, that he seems very modern. And I think it goes further than that. We've not yet gotten to Roger Williams' vision. It's a great vision. And, you know, we got to keep working. But we're not there yet. I think what Martha calls the tradition exemplified, and that grows out of Roger Williams' thinking on liberty of consciousness and equality, I guess I would phrase as a tradition, and it's definitely there. And I think, for me, the most heartening example of it actually comes from my first book, where my colleague Peter Manceau and I were traveling around the country looking at different religious communities. And because we were two men in a car from New York and asking strange questions, in certain parts of the country, that's enough for people to assume that you're a gay couple. And so we thought we'd let that ride and to see what happened. We happened not to be a couple, but we thought we'd let that ride and see what happens. And I remember a church down in East Texas, Pastor George McVeigh, this was a fundamentalist, proudly fundamentalist cowboy church. They do everything through cowboy songs and so on. Very homophobic, very anti-gay, very exclusivist, everything in this. But they welcomed us into their community. And they actually even prayed for our book. And they prayed about it in terms, they said, Lord, just let it be a good book and just let it say what these boys want to say in their heart. And I thought, this is incredible. These people, if you ask them, if you survey, the Pew Trust were to survey them, you know, what their views were, they would come up as the most intolerant people on earth. And they want to be intolerant, but in practice, they can't be as intolerant as they want to be. And in fact, they were, I think, adhering to that tradition of liberty of conscience. They could not impose their religion on us. And that, to me, is tremendously heartening. But, you know, that's a tradition. And I think there is another tradition that goes back to the beginning. And, you know, I think you could trace just as easily the history of sort of American thought on these things through Jonathan Edwards, to Charles Finney, to Dwight Moody's, not much of a thinker, to Billy Sunday, who never really had a thought in his head at all, but was an incredible preacher. And into the 20th century, where we get this really fascinating, maybe new tradition of a very subtle kind of establishment that recognizes it can use language like accommodation as a strategy, but not a principle, and that it can infuse the public square with a civil religion that won't really bother anybody, but it can do so very much with the idea. They also think that there's a place that we haven't gotten to yet, a city upon a hill that they want to become, they want to get to. Just as I think Williams has a vision for us, they see another vision. And I think their vision is very sophisticated. It's a very sophisticated one, and they're very savvy about using the language of accommodation, using the language of religious freedom, even using the language of separation to pursue ends that they would never call theocratic, but I think certainly pretty much tossed the First Amendment, at least, out the window.
Well, we got to talk about that. We got to talk about what's the test of it. My test, I got to say, from now on, is what would Roger say or what would Roger do? And in a sense, it's the question underlying this whole conversation. What would Roger Williams say about the condition of church and state in these United States in 2008? But come back to the family in Washington. You talk about the openness of cowboy Christians in East Texas. The family, the Jesus people who refer to themselves as a kind of mafia outside Washington, welcomed you in, Jeff Charlotte. They have nothing to hide because they write nothing down. Their main event every year is the National Prayer Breakfast, which is like motherhood and apple pie beyond criticism. And yet it raises the hair on the back of your neck to read the subtext and to hear even the agendas at home and abroad that these people stand for. Would you introduce us to these extraordinarily nice and good people who were generous to you?
Yes.
And why they scare us so?
and why I did so wrong by them by putting all their secrets in a book. The family is a 70-year-old network. It goes back to the 1930s when a group of businessmen looked at the Great Depression and concluded that it was a divine punishment on the United States for the sin of disobedience. And I think obedience becomes one of the really key issues here, and it makes it difficult, this question of obedience. I'll come back to that. I want to talk about that with Martha, this question of religious conservatives' idea of obedience versus the idea of accommodation. But to them, the disobedience had taken the form of the New Deal. What this meant was that people were organizing themselves, trying to change their lot in life. They were particularly alarmed by organized labor. That seemed a terrible affront because they had a very literalist reading of a verse from Paul's letters to the Romans, chapter 13, verse 1. The powers that be are ordained of God. Well, the founder of the group, Abraham Verady, at that time was a spiritual counselor to Henry Ford. Henry Ford, according to his view, was one of the powers that be. And here were these labor organizers challenging his authority. And that was a form of disobedience, and that's why God was punishing America with this economic trouble. So they formed around this idea that that they had to minister to the elites, and the elites can help the rest of us, pass the blessings down the rest of us, in as much as the elites are able to govern effectively and ensure the obedience to the public of this sort of divine will. The founder of the group had a vision one night in which he said Christianity had gotten it wrong for 2,000 years by focusing on the poor, the weak, the suffering, the down and out. God came to him one night in April 1935 and said, Verady, this is what I want you to do, not the poor, but the powerful. I call these people the up and out. And that's who they've ministered to ever since. And they created the National Prayer Breakfast. You mentioned like apple pie. 1953, and there's a lot of documents around it, actually. They do write things down, fortunately. They left 600 boxes of documents at Billy Graham's archives, which is how I was able to do this, but they are sort of wary of the public. 1953, they found the National Prayer Breakfast with the explicit idea that no one at that point is going to oppose prayer. What politician is going to come out and say, I'm opposed to prayer? And then if they can get this ritual, that will be a consecration of the nation to Christ. It's not an ecumenical event at all. Internal documents say anything can happen. Even the Quran could be read, but Jesus is there. He is infiltrating the world. And in fact, Eisenhower, the first president to attend, understood that, saw it as a violation of the First Amendment, didn't want to go, but he had political debts to pay to the family which had organized an evangelical vote for him. And so he went, creating this ritual. And that's the way they've always worked, not pounding on the door like James Dobson or the late Jerry Falwell and presenting these very open challenges to the separation of church and state, but working from within. And they're able to sort of overturn the Establishment Clause by using religious authority and religious arguments for policies that I think might disturb many of us. You know, in the book, I talk about their role over the years in arranging U.S. support for dictators like Papa Doc Duvalier of Haiti and Suharto of Indonesia, men whom they had identified as anointed by God for a particular purpose. And where the Williams tradition speaks of conscience, that's the key point here. They think of purpose. Conscience is irrelevant to them. And as they'll emphasize again and again, you are nothing before God. You have no conscience. You are just a tool. You have a purpose, and your fulfillment in life is going to be in how you can serve that purpose that God has anointed for you, whether it be being the dictator of Indonesia or being a citizen who doesn't ask too many questions.
Jeff Charlotte, you know, I must say that the family, as you write about it, reminded me a lot of Opus Dei, which long before, you know, the Da Vinci Code made it famous. I mean, I remember them recruiting young Catholics like me when I was in college. It was of course, it's Spanish, but it has the same sort of secret power at the top militancy all around it. Is that a fair connection to make? Opus Dei, fair to the family?
Both founded in 1935, both founded by some rather brilliant men who had come to the conclusion that democracy had more or less run its course. You know, the founder of Opus Dei and the founder of the family were both looking at European fascism and communism at the time and seeing these in 1935 as these incredibly vigorous ideologies, which they both rejected. And, you know, Opus Dei is often considered fascist. the family is also very close to fascism, and very literally in terms of the people that they supported. But neither were fascists. They envisioned them their religious approach as giving them this sort of this third way beyond fascism and communism, and democracy apparently was not much of an option for them. And the other relevant, they also both sort of favor the elite, this idea that we can affect great change and even achieve social justice through trickle-down religion by ministering to the elite. And they're both very secretive. And I think that's given rise to some very distracting ideas about, you know, sort of conspiracy theories. You know, the awful, awful Da Vinci Code, one of the really sort of bigoted books of the last couple decades, which distract us from the real challenge that these groups present to democracy. They're not conspiracies. They are secretive. They're entitled to be secretive. You're allowed to do that. Partly, I think, because they understand that in as much as they promote themselves as a big public organization, any organization that rises falls. The family is the oldest and most enduring Christian right organization in Washington, and they've done that by not attaching themselves to any particular faction and not by seeking publicity. Doug Coe, the leader of the group, in a sermon that you can actually find online at the website of the Navigators, another Christian right group also founded in 1935, says that the family functions invisibly like the mafia. They keep the organization invisible. Everything visible is transitory. Everything invisible is permanent and lasts forever. The more you can make your organization invisible, the more influence it will have. You know, that should scare the hell out of us in terms of democracy, but it's not a conspiracy. In fact, it's protected by the Establishment Clause, and we need to confront it not with the language of saying these guys are breaking the laws. In fact, they're oftentimes making the laws. But I think with the very vision that Martha brings us from Roger Williams, and we need to confront
it. I was just going to say, what would Roger Williams want to know about the family, and what would he... What would he urge us to do about it? Martha?
Well, I think, first of all, he would want them to have the same kind of respect for atheists, for people who are non-Christians of various types, that they have for themselves and their friends. And that means not refusing to criticize. If you think the other person is wrong, you have every right to say so, but not making laws that cast those other groups and people in a fundamentally subordinate role. And it's very hard to resist the temptation to do that, because if you think you're right, then you think, well, what's the harm in having the government state those truths? And that makes us stronger when we fight the good fight and so on. So I think he would be very – I agree with Jeff. I mean, first of all, I agree with Jeff that there is not just one tradition. There have always been several traditions. And I begin my book by talking about my own family, who were Puritans in Massachusetts, who came over on the Mayflower, and who were involved in various kinds of repressive activity. And then many years later, they were not too happy when I converted to Judaism. You know, so people always want to say these people are the in-group and other people are the out-group. We have to watch out for that tendency all over the place in our lives. And I think today Williams would really see a big threat to the Establishment Clause, and he would see it in the subtle areas that Jeff is talking about. But particularly, I'm worried about a case that came before the Supreme Court last year, which I didn't write about in the book because it was too recent, namely one where the president is now allowed to use his discretionary funds because their citizens are taxed for it, but not for a specific purpose. So any money that's not taxed for a specific purpose, the president can decide to use to establish the religion of his choice. The case came up in connection with the faith-based initiatives and whether any citizen has the legal standing to challenge those on Establishment Clause grounds. And the appeals court, my own colleague at the University of Chicago, Richard Posner, had written a very eloquent opinion saying that we have to really protect the Establishment Clause. We have to be sure that the ordinary citizen has standing to challenge these uses of discretionary money. But the Supreme Court overruled it. And I think that's one of the most alarming things that's happened in this recent Supreme Court.
Jeff Charlotte, what connection does the Christianity of the family make with American foreign policy?
Yeah, I think that's another area where there's a very dangerous encroachment on establishment. you know, in terms of sort of protecting what Roger Williams would say, you know, he says, well, you've got to have respect for other people and so on. And what the family did, once they had sort of achieved their first goal, which was rolling back the power of organized labor, and they considered the 1947 Taft-Hartley Act, which rolled back much of the gains of the New Deal, one of their first victories, they began moving overseas. And I mentioned Papa Doc. That was one of their first real sort of conquests, you might say, in developing nations. In 1959, they sent a delegation of Senator Frank Carlson and Senator Homer Capehart and a group of American businessmen to interview Duvalier and find out, was this a man of God? They agreed that he was, despite the odd little eccentricity that he thought he was God. And they returned and immediately began using their positions on their various committees to start rearranging the tariffs in Haiti's favor and eventually to supplying all kinds of aid for one of the really the most murderous regimes, purely murderous regimes in the Western Hemisphere. And they then started repeating that trick again and again and again with Suharto, the dictator of Indonesia, killed perhaps, it's hard to say, 500,000 of his own citizens. Now, Suharto was a Muslim. And this gets interesting. And in fact, in the 80s, they did the same thing with a dictator in Somalia named Siad Barre, who described himself as a Quranic Marxist, hardly a likely ally for the Christian right. But what they were really interested in was his willing to obey their concept of the American Christ. And Suharto actually was willing, as was Siad Barre, was willing to pray to Jesus with American delegations in return for American guns. And in the case of Somalia, for instance, Siad Barre wrote a very plain letter. He says, I'm happy to meet Senator Grassley, Chuck Grassley, still serving from Iowa, and we can have a wonderful time talking about Jesus, and here are some things I need. I need my defense budget doubled. I've provided a list of armaments. I need a meeting with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and I need a hands-off policy while I crack down on rebels in the North. And the family wrote back, in effect, done, done, and done. And so when we look at the history books, it was. So
will that letter be in the history books? I mean, are we talking about real documents here?
Yeah, we're talking about real documents. I mean, the family dumped 600 boxes of documents in the Billy Graham Center archives and at Wheaton College, which is a tremendous resource for scholars who are looking at the history of evangelical in America. Unfortunately, many of the scholars there are interested in the history of missions, and these are good subjects and so on, but we need more scholars to go there and look at foreign policy, for instance, and see what we can learn there. What this does, of course, is in the same way that, a law favoring perhaps religious schools or something might just one kind of religious school versus another is going to discriminate against one group. This is and while the citizens of Somalia are not entitled to the protection of the Establishment Clause, here we have the family promoting religious beliefs, promoting a religious worldview that leads them to believe that certain dictators are chosen by God and immune from questions of morality. And the real victims of that, of course, are the people of Somalia or Indonesia or more recently the Central Asian republics, to which the family has been helping to funnel support through the Silk Road Act of 1999. And the secondary victims of that, in fact, are the rest of us, we here in the United States, who expect our foreign policy, to have some kind, not total transparency, but some level of transparency, B, to be in the interest of America, not in the interest of the religious views of particular politicians, and C, to respect the Logan Act, which holds that private citizens can't conduct diplomacy. And that's how the family always does it, with sort of private public partnerships. Senator Grassley traveling with Doug Coe, the leader of the group, who is a private citizen, and effectively conducting diplomacy for the United States.
And well, what's the thinking connection between the missionary impulse and American power in the world? Do these ideas cohere?
Sure. I mean, they cohere through conflation, but it's a very subtle conflation, the conflation of American identity and Christian identity. But we should never make the mistake of thinking that Christian conservatives, and especially elite Christian conservatives, are, you know, marching forth with a cross wrapped in the flag. They tend to be more subtle about that. So, for instance, many of the politicians who travel on behalf of the family will do something. Maybe they have a junket to some foreign nations, And well, one example is given to me with Senator Jim Inhofe of Oklahoma, who has traveled in Africa for both a family and another similar group called Christian Embassy. And Inhofe, just to make clear to the nations he's visiting, that he is not going to force them to accept Christianity, that Christianity is not American, that he has a separate identity as a representative of American Christianity. He says, I've come here not to talk about politics. He says, we can talk about that later. What I want to talk about first is my personal faith in Jesus. And, I mean, this is just the most disingenuous baloney possible. For a U.S. senator to understand that, especially in some of these smaller nations where the family and Christian Embassy and these other groups have recognized that they can have a lot of influence, Jim Inhofe could call in on this radio program and none of us are going to feel particularly intimidated by him. In a small country or even a significant country like Uganda, a U.S. senator is a representative of the most powerful nation in the world, a representative of a nation that dispenses a whole lot of money. And if that man comes, he says, the first thing I want to talk about is Jesus. I think we can forgive. We can forgive the locals for thinking, well, in America, the cross and country are very much combined. So that's how they can justify it. But we also have to keep in mind that that missionary impulse connected to American power has roots in another key idea of Christian conservatism. That I think needs to be discussed just much more broadly. Issues like abortion, same-sex marriage, these are very important. They don't date back that far as real concerns for fundamentalists. But economics do, and the idea of biblical capitalism and the idea of opening world markets to capital and the gospel. Pastor Ted Haggard, who was a megachurch pastor and a very powerful guy, not part of the family, he's sort of the other side of things, the populist front. Was very clear on this, that where the markets go, the gospel follows. And that explained, for instance, why so many Christian fundamentalists were very involved and very excited about and listening on James Dobson's radio program to news from the Ukraine a few years ago when the Orange Revolution was happening. And they saw the Orange Revolution as this great revolution for free markets, which it was, and also for democratic freedom, which it was. But they were also quite certain that the gospel would follow, and that so again for them they want freedom of religion so that they can have their religion, and once that's established you don't really need to accommodate much more.
Martha Nussbaum and Jeff Charlotte, I wish you'd both just stand way back and consider this 2008 campaign up to the 4th of July as a sort of experiment in nature and a demonstration of how religion and politics actually work in this country. I wonder what stands out. But, for example, what should we learn from the rise in the Republican primaries of the Baptist preacher Mike Huckabee at the expense, it seemed, of the Mormon Mitt Romney? I also want to get this matter of what will we make in the long run of the apparent scandal, a sort of media scandal of Jeremiah Wright and his over-the-top version of the prophetic preacher in what had been Barack Obama's church. What are you learning about the theory from the practice you observe out there in 08, Martha Nussbaum?
Well, I guess I was very distressed by some of the things that Huckabee was saying, because I think he hadn't really thought about the whole issue of creating in-groups and out-groups, or the idea that endorsing a certain brand of Christianity is subordinating other people. I was actually even more distressed by Romney's speech, because obviously he had thought about it very, very carefully. And what he did was to endorse exactly what Justice Scalia said in the Ten Commandments cases, namely that it was fine to advance or endorse monotheism and disfavor other religions. And so I thought that was also very, very unfortunate. And what we need is a statement that says not only do we not take sides among the religions, but we also don't take sides between religion and non-religion. And no one is standing up and saying that. It's just not possible to say, as a presidential candidate, that atheists deserve respect. But Roger Williams already knew that. He was the first one who said atheists should have fully equal civil rights. He called them anti-Christians. But anyway, Locke didn't even say that 50 years later, but Roger Williams did. And so I think we need to have candidates stand up and say that. But even my former colleague Barack Obama, who is a wonderful candidate who certainly is trying to reach out to certain evangelicals who are concerned about poverty and social issues. I think that's a very good thing. But he's certainly not willing to say we want to show equal respect to people who have no religion at all.
Wouldn't Roger Williams have stuck his neck out for the Mormons? Of course, he didn't know them, but the Mormons, who seemed so exotic to a lot of American Protestants?
Oh, sure. And, who knows? I think he probably would have thought that there were morals laws that would have restricted polygamy, because he did think that adultery could be criminalized on secular, not religious grounds. But on the other hand, he was prepared to allow the Jews an exception to the incest laws for uncle-niece marriages. So you never know. I mean, so even in this very fraught domain of sexuality, he was willing to stick his neck out in some cases. But yeah, I think the unfair treatment of the Mormons in this nation's history is one of the great scandals, and next only to the anti-Catholicism and then the later persecution of the Jehovah's Witnesses. So he would have hated all those things.
What would he have made of candidates, and not just Huckabee and Romney, sort of courting the base, as it came to be known in the Bush era? I mean, what would he make even now of, Barack Obama's passage to the mountaintop with Billy Graham in North Carolina?
Well, I think he would have thought that it's very dangerous to urge us to come together on religious territory. He would have wanted them to stress the common moral ground on which we live together, and then say, look, we all have our different ways of connecting that to religion or non-religion. And then probably, as a religious man himself, he would have asserted his own religious views. And he did think that public officials could do that. Now, I think one has to be very careful when one does that. But there's no reason why one shouldn't do that if it's done so delicately that one makes it very clear that that's not the government speaking. That's just one flawed person trying to find his or her way.
Once more on Jeremiah Wright, I still marvel in a way that Reverend Wright's over-the-top version of the prophetic preacher, denouncing his people, denouncing America, or invoking the Almighty's wrath on a flawed country, was so quickly sort of read out of the realm of acceptability, even in church. What would Roger Williams have made of that?
It's funny, because the one group of people he really had trouble with were the Quakers. And these were not the polite bourgeois Quakers of Pennsylvania, but George Fox and his crew, who really did like to say very divisive things, like to insult other people, like to shout them down. And Roger Williams actually hated that, and he really had trouble with it. He bent over backwards to be fair to them and give them equal civil rights. But it was the one real struggle he had, because what he really hated was trying to insult and demean other people.
Jeff Charlotte, I wonder what you're making of the 08 campaign. You watch everything for kind of religious lessons or lessons about the way it's done in America. What are you learning?
Well, it's interesting. You mentioned Barack Obama going to the mountaintop, and I hate to correct you. It was John McCain who went to the mountaintop and visited
John McCain
Billy Graham.
Went, but Barack Obama's going.
Barack Obama's going, but more importantly, what Barack Obama did, and a masterful political stroke and very frightening to me in terms of what it says about potential cynicism in his campaign, is today he announced that, in fact, he was going to expand faith-based initiatives. And
yes.
I immediately got a joyous press release from David Kuo, the former special assistant to President Bush, who ran faith-based initiatives more or less in the first administration, who declared with great happiness that Obama is out-Bushing Bush. And, I think when we look at faith-based initiatives and you look at the ways in which sort of these violations of Establishment Clause come together with religious liberty and other issues too. Faith-based initiatives going back to the late 60s, which in the book is when I argue that I think the ideas really started percolating on that, was seen as a privatizing engine. And it was seen precisely as a way of getting around certain restrictions in government. And if you could privatize a lot of these services, well, then you don't even really have to wrestle with the Establishment Clause if you can take them out of government hands. And so what we had this really interesting case here with Barack Obama. Suddenly, outreach to evangelicals is wonderful and admirable. How far is he reaching? He's just reached further than John McCain is willing to reach. We have and John McCain, you know, the man whom I believe is our first atheist major candidate for president. And, you know, of course, he declares himself a Baptist, although he was sort of surprised when someone asked about his baptism, because apparently he didn't know that that was part of being a Baptist. he's whether he's a believer or not, it's not a large part of his life. So we have this strange inversion, and I'm afraid that too many people are out there saying, well, this is a balancing of things. Whereas I see this campaign, one of the most religiously infused campaigns of my lifetime, certainly, as a sign of the whole thing just shifting rightward so rapidly that we're forgetting to ask those questions about equality, about liberty of conscience, about what government does, about why faith-based initiatives are needed to achieve the very basic goals that government was designed to achieve. You know, in so many places that we're asking churches to do what the government says it's supposed to do. Let churches do what they're going to do. And I think we're going to see more, because I think Obama is hungry now, and I think he thinks that he can really steal this evangelical vote, and maybe he can.
Martha Nussbaum, where do you stand on faith-based projects and faith-based sort of distribution of government work?
Well, I think they're a very, very bad idea when any kind of taxpayer money is used in the process. First of all, these that Bush has been running are really very sectarian. They're primarily Christians involved, and there's no attempt to be fair to other religions. People are – there are subtle criteria for getting benefits from them that are religious in nature. But even if that weren't the case, even if they were ever so careful to make sure that Hindus and Buddhists and so on were included, well, it would still be preferring religion over non-religion. And there would still be some requirement of some kind of interest in piety that would condition your benefits. And that is just not allowed. And I think the one reason they're so concerned to prevent a constitutional challenge is they know they would lose. So the only thing that prevents them from losing a constitutional challenge is this issue of standing, namely that no citizen has been held to have standing because it's discretionary money that's being used. But it is clearly unconstitutional, and it's in addition, it's very bad.
Martha Nussbaum and Jeff Charlotte, I'm wondering, do you ever wonder what religious questions you would answer and what religious avowals you would make in your own presidential campaign?
I actually do think about that because
I
of course I make public speeches and so on, but I am a Reformed Jew and I talk a lot about my own religious views. I've even published an article on them, and I'm having an adult bat mitzvah this summer, so here I am. I'm going to be making a speech on that in front of lots of people. But you know what I try to do? I mean, I of course my views, religious views, are very inclusive and universalist, as indeed the tradition of Reform Judaism is. So there's less tension between the religious views and the public views than there would be in the case of many people. But nonetheless, I try to say, you know, those are views that are my views as a citizen, and what I want is a politics that respects those views but respects a lot of other views, too, that I don't happen to hold.
Your views are your views, but if you were running for office and somebody said, now, Ms. Nussbaum, where do you stand on God, for example? What do you believe? What would be appropriate to say in that context?
You know, I think you can say anything so long as you make it clear that this is just one person and you're trying to find your way and this is what you believe, but you respect people who believe something different, and that's not the way you're going to run the country. What I think, though, is that in America today, if you said you're agnostic about God, which I have said in print while being a very devoted member of my Reform congregation, you couldn't be a candidate for public for high office in this country. And so I think it's very unfortunate that that's the case.
Do you think about it, Jeff?
Oh, God, please strike me down with lightning should I ever run for any public office.
Come on, we have our fantasies, though.
You know, the way that I think about this is when we talk about religion in the public sphere, and here I am speaking as one person, I think there's sort of two visions that we can see and two really ideas of how religion and politics can mesh in America. They both happen to be Christian because while this is not a Christian nation, it is a nation with an awful lot of Christians. And there's the salvation ideal, and the salvation ideal translates into politics as a politics of the status quo, as your salvation will be taken care of in the next life. You need to get right with God. It's individualized. It's not thinking collectively. And then there's this other deliverance ideal, which is much more appealing to me. And deliverance, you know, salvation, salvation is a matter of revelation. Deliverance is a matter of exodus. Salvation is the ending of a story. Deliverance is the beginning of a story. Deliverance is the idea that we need to get up and do something to make this world the place we want it to be. And that's that deliverance is the idea, I think, that brings us to that place that Roger Williams, I think, spoke of so prophetically, that we are not there yet where we can all participate in this public square. So I think that to me is what I long to hear from politicians. And, you know, at times I've heard it from Barack Obama, who comes out of this great liberation theology tradition. And one of the tragedies of the trashing of Jeremiah Wright was that nobody paid attention to his prophetic voice. They did. They paid attention to his anger, but they didn't pay attention to his vision. And his vision was one of very much of a deliverance ideal that I think when we look back at American political rhetoric, the speeches that we have loved so much have not been, they've been about people making democracy themselves, deliverance from, you know, the Jews get up and walk out of Egypt. They don't wait for God to do this. They don't believe. Sure, they're the chosen people. What good does that do them if they don't have 2 feet on which to walk and get out of Egypt? You know, you look back at Lincoln and you look back at the speeches that people love about JFK. These are ideals of people making democracy. And some of those people are making democracy as a religious practice. Some of them are not doing it as a religious practice. But the bottom line there is the making of democracy, not any kind of religious authority that's supposed to sort of be an umbrella above all.
That's well said. Let me just say, I mean, I think stuck at traffic lights, I think about Dan Rather actually putting questions to the candidates in 2004, just asking them, like John Kerry, what do you believe? And I thought the question was in some way offensive. I think today, if it were me, and I think about it a lot, actually, I'd try to give a Roger Williams-ish answer to the effect that every one of us is born to a search for inward and invisible meanings of the utmost importance, and I'm on my search. It may, in fact, be the most precious part of my life, but it will not be part of my political life, short of my memoirs, and it'll not be part of anything like a political interrogation, so let's go to the next question. My last question for you, Jeff, is have we gone irreparably far to satisfy a Roger Williams standard? In the direction of theocracy?
We've gone irreparably far. I don't like the word theocracy. I don't think we ever will be a theocracy, but we will have a severe establishment, and we'll have establishment of a religion that's very comfortable with the status quo. It's a religion of what is, and it's a religion that shuts down dissent, and it's a religion that shuts down prophetic voices as well. Yes, I think we have irreparably gone too far in the United States, but that doesn't mean we stop speaking and living and dissenting. And for those of us who feel religious speaking in prophetic terms, and those of us who don't speaking in political terms, you know, I think hope is something that you have when you're looking at a situation that reason doesn't quite support. So we have to be hopeful, and hopeful is hope is actually a very dark place, I think. But we have irreparably established a certain kind of religion in American life. So there's no going back. I think there's only moving forward until we get to that place that I think a country that Roger Williams would like to live in.
Out of tribulation, said St. Paul, comes experience, comes patience, comes hope. Jeff Charlotte, thank you enormously for this conversation.
Thank you, Chris.
Martha Nussbaum in Chicago, thank you for joining us on Open Source.
Thank you so much, Chris.